whole Rosa Parks story is so important because both of us were taught that on the day of her arrest, she was simply tired after a long day of work, and she refused to give up her seat to a white man in the colored people's section of the bus. That basic sketch is true, but there is so much more to the story. The fact that Rosa was a member of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, what we know as the NAACP, since 1943, as well as being married to Raymond Parks, another member of the NAACP, demonstrates that she had a great deal of support for her act of protest. Also, we heard in her interview earlier that she attended a two-week intensive training at what was then called the Highlander Folk School in Tennessee in August of 1955. The event on the bus happened on December 1st, 1955. It was no accident that she had been a member of the NAACP for 12 years before she apparently was just tired. And so the training, intensive training at Highlander, which Joanna mentioned, and I'll get back to in a second, was 2 weeks of intensive training for civil rights and the rights of workers. Highlander was commonly known in that area in many parts as the commie place or the commie center or the communist whatever. So that's the kind of reputation, which I thought was a great reputation. So now the name is the Highlander Research and Education Center. It was founded in 1932 by Miles Horton, a very, very well-known trainer for community organizers. The center has had many forms, as Joanna made reference, has had many, many forms of harassment over the years, including the arson attack on May 29th of this year. And it was just, the attack was one of the things that prompted this service for me. That had a big impact on me, that it was targeted. And so I'll continue to talk about that. Many civil rights leaders, including SNCC, you may know, remember, older folks, younger folks, the SNCC was a student nonviolent coordinating committee members, were trained at Highlanders as well. Martin Luther King gave a speech there on the 25th anniversary. Rosa Parks' story is emblematic of the contrast between community organizing and individualism in our society. Rosa, an educated African-American woman, knew that an individual acting alone would not be able to defeat segregation and Jim Crow in the South. Her organizing work was a catalyst for the civil rights movement. She was called the mother of the civil rights movement and stayed involved with the movement for the rest of her life. Later on in her life, she was often poor because she donated so much of her money to different causes and groups that she knew were making a change in the world. That's how dedicated she was. Individualism, on the other hand, is the pervasive, ubiquitous propaganda in our society. All the media are constantly espousing it in every possible format. It's not just have it your way at Burger King. Much of our so-called gig economy is sold to workers on the philosophy of individualism. Set your own hours. Work when you want to work. But lost to these workers are the stability and the benefits of a full-time job. Also, in days past, in the 70s or 80s, and fortunately some of us still fortunate enough know a thing called a pension. Many young people now are sold, have your own retirement. Set aside your own money, and you don't need a pension. is all another manifestation of individualism, which of course is a huge disaster. All the research shows that people are struggling so much to live. It's very hard for people to save for retirement with their own money. My first experience with the movement and organizing came in the 1980s when I moved to San Luis Obispo from the Philadelphia area. I became fully involved in Central American solidarity movement. I formed some of the deepest friendships of my life up to that point doing that work. We were active in a cause bigger than ourselves, and the compassion and wisdom I experienced from my new friends filled me with hope and strength. When I tried to recruit others to this powerful, just movement, I saw resistance in the form of people telling me the issue overwhelmed or paralyzed them. At first, I thought they were just making an excuse. But later, I realized these people didn't have the emotional capacity to address this difficult, painful subject. That's when I also realized that it wasn't just a matter of facts or information. I studied, watched documentaries, and attended a ton of speeches about Central America. And I thought if people only knew what I knew, without boasting, mind you, they would change their minds and get involved. I did presentations, including being the speaker at the first Unitarian Universalist service I ever attended, which was also in San Luis Obispo. I'm a little embarrassed to mention it, but I presented a film during this first service, and I shouldn't be embarrassed about it. You can, you know, it was the 80s. The film was by Dr. Charlie Clements, who was the director of medical aid to El Salvador, and he later became the director of the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee, and he's been fully dedicated to the cause his whole life. Like the Central American movement and other movements I've participated in, I continue to feel the major issue is not the facts, which are readily available on the net, on the internet. You can find, it's just right there at the tip of your finger there. But rather, people feel as an individual they should be able to fix things, and when the issue is too large, they give up and get cynical. This is a very major, there's huge downside to individualism. We're constantly being sold as this wonderful thing that gives us so much freedom, so much choice. And this, I'm seeing this a lot, that a feeling of paralysis, overwhelmed, fragility. There's the number one book on the New York Times called White Fragility, which has to do with this phenomenon happening with white people who somehow cannot deal with racism because they just get so flustered and so upset and so paralyzed. I just can't do anything. And it's very common. I mean, it's a New York Times bestseller list for months and months. Churches are having book clubs about this. It's a major phenomenon, and it's very serious. I attended a Dharma speech by Bernie Glassman, a great Zen priest and activist, about 20 years ago. Actually, it was at the San Francisco Unitarian Church. At that talk, Bernie works really funny as a Dharma teacher. He usually, in a Dharma session, there's a Dharma talk. You know, the priest, the master will come out and share words of wisdom and enlightenment, which are always really excellent and wonderful. But Bernie has what's called the Socratic method. And you know, the Socratic method is based on questioning. So Bernie, when he would come out, and he does this all the time, I think I saw him another time as well, but I know he does. He comes out and he makes I sit down and I'll stand and say, okay, does anybody have any questions? And that's it. It's just the whole time goes question and answer, which is really cool. So, at this event at the San Francisco Church, a person said there are so many problems and they feel overwhelming. Then I asked, what can I do as an individual? And Bernie said, nobody can do everything, but everybody can do something. And to that I would add, anybody can join a group and get the support and the strength they need to make a difference in the world. I feel very fortunate that I've been able to be a part of other movements since then. And each time I form deep friendships with very compassionate and wise people. This congregation has been a very supportive group of people over the years. When I was upset or worried about a social justice issue, I knew our social justice committee would be involved in presenting speakers and attending rallies or demonstrations about those things that really concern me. At this point, you may be wondering why I'm talking about groups when we have a covenant group, a woman's group, a men's group, an elders group. We have groups. I have a feeling that some well-meaning and knowledgeable people will get more involved with our climate, environmental movement if they know they will be supported spiritually and emotionally. The climate news, of course, is very bleak. But I firmly believe that people have a container to release their own grief and fears, then we can be empowered to not only do the work, but to do it in a sustainable way. This has been my personal experience through the Iraq wars, among many other social justice movements. So I will put out feelers to see if there's interest, and if there's enough interest, I will approach the proper people and see if we can start what Joanna Macy called despair and empowerment work during the nuclear freeze movement. And I wouldn't use that title, but her work would be the basis that she understood. I took a course with Joanna Macy at Star King, and she still lives here in Berkeley, and she's just an incredible leader. She just turned 90 years old, Chris Macy's mother. And so she knew about the emotional impact of this work and how it was so important to not just present facts and information. I can't tell you how deep that resonates with me, that there was another example was during the election of, I think it was George W. Bush running against John Kerry. There was a friend from the Buddhist Peace Fellowship said, you know, if people just had the facts, they would vote the right way. And she formed a whole group of people, and they said, these are the facts about the pharmaceutical companies. These are the facts about employment. These are the facts about foreign policy. And I'm not, you know, I'm not dismissing facts, of course, or dismissing science or information by any means. But I realized very deeply through the process of going through life that this thing about fragility, about paralysis, about being frozen is not just an excuse. Many people, because of the individualism in our society, one of the major downsides
is an amazing amount of isolation that Facebook doesn't overcome. I'm practically addicted to Facebook, so I'm making a confession here myself. So, but I realized, so I'm really excited because you look around and the information is so devastating about climate. I'm not going to go into any details. You know they are. I'm not here to trigger you and make you depressed. I mean, you know it's really, really bad. And it's like, wow, what is going on? Why are not more people just like stampeding against, you know, chaining themselves to Chevron and to the coal companies and, you know, thousands of people. In England, they're doing that. I mean, they're just, you know, they have this, anybody know the name of the group? It's
Rebellion. Station
Rebellion? Extinction Rebellion, yeah. These people, they know what time it is. They're like, whoa, this is really serious. We're in an emergency here with the climate. It's a catastrophe, it's an emergency. They're chaining themselves and stuff. They're getting arrested. It's like, we're not going to survive as a species if this keeps going the way it's going. And it's like, yeah, okay, they're right on it. And we have wonderful groups here. We're going to talk to Barbara Chan in a minute. I mean, we have 350.org, we have Greenpeace, we have groups that are doing a lot, Indivisible Berkeley. A lot of people are doing good work. But I don't know about you, but it just feels like it's just not enough, you know. And for me, and it's the difficulty is, if you've never experienced a movement, if you've never been involved in civil rights or the women's movement or civil rights movement or racial justice movement, you don't. It's so hard to make that leap from being an individual, which, you know, I can watch my shows when I want to and I can do this when I want to, and the so-called freedom. It's so hard to make that leap from individualism to solidarity, to be in a movement. That's why I did this reading for Marge Piercy. I mean, Marge Piercy wrote that poem probably in the 70s. I mean, it's in this book by Marilyn Sewell, who was a Unitarian Universalist minister who got this anthology of women's writings. And that was published like in 91 or before. So these issues are not old. I mean, they're not new. And they've been around for a long time. And I think everybody has their own theory. What I'm saying to you is, this is my personal theology. We sometimes in the summer we have people come up and say, this is my personal theology. This is what I believe. This is what I think what's going on. And so one of the things is that, and again with individualism, see people say, we'll have conversations and say, wow, you know, it's really bad. It's like, yeah, it's really bad. You know, what are you doing? Oh, I'm recycling, you know? And it's like, okay, all right. And that's important, you know? And Barbara's got some stuff over here about plastics and information, and you can talk to her after the service. It's really important. But there's so many dynamics to it. I mean, we totally have to stop coal. I mean, the fact that anybody is still burning coal at this stage, at this point of the planet, is like an individual who has emphysema and lung cancer and still smoking 3-4 packs of cigarettes a day. I mean, that's just about as close as I can imagine that our planet using coal is so destructive. So destructive that there's no reason in the world that anybody would tolerate the continuance of that. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. You know, and that's just, excuse the metaphor, but what's left of the iceberg? What's left of the iceberg is coal. And then, of course, it's fossil fuels. And all of these have to be stopped as soon as possible. There's no reason for any of them. They're all doing so much damage to our, to the whole world, obviously. You know this. But the thing is that what we have to do And I wish that therapists would do that too, do this as well, is that when the subject comes up, the other person would say, yeah, wow, it's so overwhelming, or I recycle. And we really have to say, you know, have you thought about joining a group? Because joining a group, being in a group, whether it's 350.org, Greenpeace, Sierra Club, whatever it is just going to increase exponentially the support you receive, the strength you receive, and the continuity of moving forward. To finish, I'll tell you a prime example of somebody with well intention. There was a woman, when I went to Star King back in 89 to 92, there was a woman on the staff there who shall remain nameless, and she said, you know, I'm really tired of all this pollution. I think it's really bad. And so she decided to not drive a car anymore. So she was out at the bus stop, and she was taking the bus every day back and forth. And it was really a pain in the neck. You know, the buses don't run on schedule. If you don't take buses, the buses around here are not right on schedule, and other public transportation. And one day, she was standing, waiting at the bus, watching all these cars going back and forth, and she just said, forget it. Why should I do this? I'm just going to go back to the way I was. So it's very clear. Was she in a group? No, of course not. Did she have any sort of emotional support about doing this? No. It's an individualistic society, right? You say, oh, I'm going to do this. And then we get burned out, we get frustrated, and it's like, wow, man, that didn't work. It doesn't work because we need to be in groups. I feel this so strongly. I mean, I can't tell you how strongly, well, I think it's coming across. It's so important now. It's so important. So if you're interested, I'm thinking about starting a group here, dealing with this, dealing with the feelings, the sadness, the grief, the fear, oh my God, and then working through that to the point of feeling empowered to take some action collectively and to move forward, to do what we can about this situation. So let me finish with it starts when you care to act. It starts when you do it again after they say no. It starts when you say we. It has to be we. It has to be we. We have to transcend our individualism. It's just so essential. And we know who we mean. And each day we mean one.